And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am Mark Gillar. My special guest today is Mr. John Stossel from Fox Business News. He is the author of one of my favorite books of all time, Give Me a Break. But he's here to talk to us today about his latest book, No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed. John, welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour.
Thank you.
Now, John, you are a man who has basically declared global warming a hoax. When Donald Trump once said to you, "No one talks to me like that," your response was, "Well, maybe it's time somebody did." And you've even gone as far as to suggest that greedy pharmaceutical companies are good for Americans. So how do you say crazy stuff like that and stay on the air?
Well, what's crazy about that? Greedy pharmaceutical companies are good for America.
How so?
And I can certainly stay in the air at Fox Business saying stuff like that because they understand free markets.
Well, I'm, of course, just teasing with you a little bit. I mean, you're on a conservative talk show, but I had to throw that out there. Now, even though you can say things like that at Fox Business News, we know that you haven't always been at Fox. I guess it's been around 18 months or so, according to the book. But you made the transition from ABC to Fox. So what was that like as far as the corporate culture is concerned?
Oh, I'm so glad I did that. It just sucked at ABC by the end. And Fox is just great in that they let me do my thing. I mean, I take a number of libertarian positions that many at Fox are not comfortable with, but nobody has ever said a word to me, "Oh, don't say that," or "Don't do that." So they believe in the open debate. And another part is that at ABC, they were all liberals, but they all thought they were down the middle, and their attitude was as if I was the only one in the whole building who had an opinion. Everybody else was just doing objective news. But Stossel was that conservative, and I was icky in many ways. But I guess we should have one, and we'll let him. We'll be very careful. We'll edit all his stuff, and everything had to go through a couple lawyers or producers who were either hostile to free markets or ignorant about them. And it was just all a battle. And so I was not offered a job by Fox. I went to Roger Ailes and begged him to hire me.
When you were at ABC, did you work with Catherine Cryer at all?
Yeah, she was one of the more reasonable people, even though she went out with Ted Turner.
I had her on the show a while back, and she struck me as fitting that definition of someone who's drifted to the left but didn't really realize they were there. Let's talk about some of these sacred cows that you've gone after in the past and that you go after in the book. Minimum wage, a good thing or a bad thing for the American worker?
The structure of No, They Can't is based on this conceit that, yes, we can, the frenzy over electing Obama, that government can make everything better. And intuition often suggests that's true. I mean, whenever there's something that scares us or a problem that makes us upset, we naturally say, there ought to be a law, government ought to do something. Even I do it sometimes, I catch myself. And minimum wage is just one example. It's intuitive that mandating a higher minimum wage helps poor people who would take an entry-level job. You can see that. Frederick Bastiat talks about the seen versus the unseen. You can see the worker who gets a raise, and some will, and they'll be happy. But what you can't see is all the people who never get hired because some company in the margin now decides not to expand or goes bankrupt or just decides not to start a new business because they're going to hire a lot of entry-level people, and now that makes that more expensive. The reporters wouldn't know who to take pictures of because the jobs don't yet exist. People say, well, without a minimum wage, there'd be a race to the bottom. Employers would pay workers nothing. But if that's the case, then how come 95% of all people now already make more than the minimum wage? The truth is that all employers are greedy, and so are workers. And employers want to pay as little as possible, and I want to get every penny from Fox I can. But it's through that negotiation that everybody decides, what the job is worth and what the worker's worth. And that's the free market. And it's a beautiful thing because it's flexible. By mandating a minimum wage, we've killed off construction jobs for beginning construction workers. People used to learn on the job. Can't do that anymore. Nobody pumps gas, or not nobody, fewer people will wash your windshield at a gas station because we've, through law, made those jobs disappear.
You were saying in your book that even college interns that used to be able to work for free so they could gain some experience before they go out in the real world aren't able to do that anymore in some places.
Well, except that they are. It's one of those weird cases where we have so many laws that nobody can really understand what they are, and not everybody obeys them. My understanding was always that two people could make a bargain. If somebody wants to work as an intern to learn, that would be their right. And we did that for years at ABC. But ABC, always extra sensitive to the latest trends in liberal thinking, decided this might be exploitation and we're going to have to pay every intern $10 an hour. And that was nice for those who got the $10, most of whom were connected people, but because they were paying, then they used half as many interns. A lot of people never got jobs. I built my whole career using interns working for local TV stations because I needed the research help, and my boss laughed at me saying, you think we're made of money? But I thought, well, I was learning much more in my TV job than I'd ever learned at college. Maybe some of these college kids would like to work for me and do some research, and I'd help teach them. And most of these kids said afterward, this was great. I learned more working for you than I learned in school. And I didn't have to pay you tuition. So it was a great thing for me and for them. And he went on to careers in journalism. But now the Obama Labor Department says, this is exploitation. And you may not hire, you may not use an intern unless you pay them, unless the intern provides no material benefit to your work. Well, why would you want someone who provided no material benefit? In fact, they even said, or may hinder your work. Interns like that, and I wanted to scream, but you know that's not the goal. But it's like the minimum wage, this sense that they're protecting people, but the reality is they take away opportunity.
John, the stimulus package really hasn't produced many jobs, and the Keynesian theorists who supported the stimulus package are now at a loss to explain it. What are your thoughts?
So I don't think you can say it hasn't produced jobs. When government spends $800 billion, that will produce some jobs. Point is that to do that, the government has no money of its own. It has to take money from somebody else, in this case the private sector. And again, it's the seen versus the unseen. We don't know what that money might have done, what good things it might have created. Far more productive jobs, cured cancer, invented the next Facebook or Google. Because the government takes money by force, we don't know the value of the jobs. And the truth is that many of those jobs they spend a buck on are really worth only 70 cents to the economy, and that's one reason we haven't seen great results from all this stimulus. But to me, the best example of that were things like Nancy Pelosi saying, the earthquake in Haiti will create an economic boom in Haiti because they'll have to rebuild. And Paul Krugman said the same thing about the attacks of 9/11, that would revitalize the economy through rebuilding in downtown New York. But it ignores the unseen, that money that goes into rebuilding is money that's not going to buy a car or buy a shirt. It's taken from somebody else. And they're only counting what they see.
So they haven't read Frederic Bastiat's broken window theory or fallacy.
Exactly. I mean, on TV, I was fighting with T. Boone Pickens, who wants government subsidies for, I guess he no longer does, for his windmills, but he still wants them for natural gas device, extra fueling stations or conversion stations. And he was explaining how that would create a job. So I broke a window and said, so I just created a job for a glassmaker and the janitor to clean it up. Did that make America richer? Well, it's easier to see then because you see that the money that goes to the glassmaker or to the janitor doesn't go to some other more useful purpose.
As for the windmill thing, they've built thousands and thousands of them in Europe, and they haven't been able to shut down one coal-powered plant, and that's because the wind doesn't always blow all the time. Same thing with the solar power. The sun doesn't always shine all the time. I just don't see it replacing fossil fuels in the near future.
But just to add to that, it's not just that the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow all the time. It's that it doesn't produce enough energy. Some people say it's a conspiracy of big oil to fight these things. Well, it's a conspiracy of physics. You'd have to cover the whole country, like Sweetwater, Texas, with windmills and solar panels to get as much energy as you get out of one big coal plant or nuclear plant.
That's very true, and of course we're subsidizing those things, and if you look at the amount of subsidy per unit of energy produced, we're subsidizing them a lot more than we do the oil industry. But I guess in the
100 to 1 is the ratio. Though the other side would say, well, you're looking at it in terms of per unit of energy produced. If you look at it in total subsidies,
right,
it's about even. But it's just much more, and nobody should get subsidies.
That's right. I was about
companies
to go there.
Yeah, get rid of all of them.
Well, you know, we've mentioned at the front of the show that you're a libertarian, but we've got so many people claiming to be libertarians that it kind of muddies the water. I think I even heard Bill Maher claim he was a libertarian. Well, explain to the audience exactly, in your opinion, what a libertarian is.
A libertarian believes that people should be allowed to do anything that's peaceful, which means we're not anarchists. We need government to make sure I don't kill you or hurt you or take your stuff. And most libertarians would go further and say we need an environmental protection agency because there's no good market mechanism to reduce pollution. My smoke goes to your lungs, so I don't have a market incentive to behave well. And I'm fine with a limited safety net because we can afford one, and it's cruel in a rich country to dismantle the monster we have now. But it ought to be limited, and private charity should compete with it. Before we got our big social welfare bureaucracy, there were thousands of mutual aid societies all over America, and nobody was starving on the streets. Private charities helped people, and they were better able to decide who needs help and who needs a kick in the butt than government, which just treats everyone the same and gets suckered, and all those mutual aid societies atrophied once government stepped in and did a worse job.
I read in the book that you wanted to do an Obamacare special at ABC, and you were unable to do that. As far as Obamacare is concerned, we saw the attacks begin before Barack Obama even took office, that, you know, we pay more for health care than any other country in the world, but our results aren't as good. And you had Michael Moore running around talking about how much better the health care system was in Cuba. What do you see the ultimate results of Obamacare being in the United States if it's allowed to stand?
Bureaucracy and the stopping of innovation in medicine, and you won't have to worry. You'll get some treatment, but you'll wait in line. It won't be good. It won't improve. You may have noticed at the end of the healthcare chapter of No, They Can't, I pointed out that Michael Moore, when he wanted to go to a weight loss clinic, he didn't go to Cuba. He went to a private clinic. And, you know, it is true what they say. We spend much more than other countries. We don't live longer. But there are reasons for that, and I give Michael Moore credit. He laughed when I pointed out that one reason was that Americans are fatter than the people in those other countries. We also drive cars more and kill each other in cars. We shoot each other more often. We have an underclass and higher infant mortality rates. We count infant mortality when the baby dies. In Cuba, they don't, unless the baby lives for a certain length of time. And all that distorts the statistics. But I think the main point is that the rest of the world does pretty well because they freeload off our innovation, off our one-third free market system, which produces the new knee replacements and Lipitor and the improvements in medicine that we so want.
Well, a lot of people don't realize, I mean, we fund the innovation for most of the world. And I can tell you right now, there's a drought in the pharmaceutical pipeline. And even though a lot of people would like to blame Obama, it actually goes back to the time when Bill Clinton was in office. Hillary Clinton was proposing Hillary Care, and pharmaceutical companies, trying to get ahead of the curve, drastically cut back on R&D and laid off a lot of people. And if you look at the amount of time it takes to bring a drug to market, we're just now seeing that drying up of the pipeline now from the Hillary Clinton years. So I can't even imagine what it's going to be like in 20 years after, you know, Obamacare was passed. I think we're just going to continue to see a drying of that innovative pipeline.
And again, here we're fighting intuition, because as rational human beings, we fear a new drug that might hurt us or a device that would go bad in our bodies. And we want mommy government to make sure that some greedy company doesn't sell us that. And we can see that and publicize the story of the person who's hurt by the drug. But what we don't see is the innovation that might have been great that never happens, because now it takes 10 years and $1 billion to introduce anything, to jump through those hoops. And some years back, the FDA held a press conference and said, this new heart drug we're approving is going to save 14,000 American lives a year. And nobody at the news conference stood up to say, hey, that's great, but wait a second, didn't that also mean you killed 14,000 people last year when the drug hadn't been approved, and the year before, and the year before? And nobody asked that because reporters don't think that way, but it did mean that. If we're going to save 14,000 lives with the drug, it also meant that taking 10 years to approve it killed 140,000 people.
I think the classic example of that is the drug metformin, which originally sold under the brand name Glucophage. It was on the world market for nearly 40 years before it was brought into the U.S. market. And when you look at all of the people who could have benefited from having an additional oral anti-diabetic medication on board with their dosing regimen, a lot of people probably died early due to complications of diabetes that could have lived longer, healthier lives. But they played around for 40 years before they approved it for the U.S. market. All the usual people came out and said it's a horrible drug, it's dangerous, it's going to kill people, and no drug company would touch it. Bristol-Myers Squibb, a company I know you're familiar with because they tried to sue you once, I know that from your previous book, actually took a chance on it, and by the time it was done, it was a $4 billion a year drug because it provided benefit to so many people. But in the United States, diabetics waited 40 years to get that, so you're absolutely right, and nobody goes back and says how many diabetics died early because you guys waited so long to put it on the U.S. market. Nobody. You never see those victims.
And people just take it. Mm-hmm. It kills people, and we get frenzied over one death, and this is hundreds of government-caused deaths. And how we sit passively by and let our government tell us, no, you are forbidden to put this in your own body. I think that's an affront to a free people.
I couldn't agree with you more, John. I have one last question for you. You know, Sean Hannity proclaimed 2008 as the year that the media died. I think you've been in media even longer than Sean has. What's your take on the current state of the media in terms of the way they seem to have circled their wagons to protect Barack Obama, not allowing him to be vetted properly? Does it surpass anything you've ever seen in your career?
No, I work for NBC, CBS, and ABC. They don't even think they're consciously protecting Obama. It's just the way they think. It's like they're steeped in the New York Times like it's a tea bag.
Wow. John, in the couple of minutes that we have left, tell people where they can get a hold of a copy of your book.
Wherever you buy books. It's called No, They Can't.
Mm-hmm.
Taking off on, yes, we can, but, you know, we can. It's just that they took we to mean government, and the subtitle, I think, is the important part. It's why government fails, but individuals succeed, and we do. If you leave us alone, individuals come up with air conditioning and cell phones and better medicines and all kinds of cool stuff.
Absolutely. John, thanks for being here today. It's been an absolute honor. Best of luck with sales of the book, and hopefully we can talk to you again sometime.
Thanks.
Once again, the name of the book is No They Can't by John Stossel, available wherever good books are sold. Next up, we have Mr. David Oliphant, who is the author of the book When All Else Fails, Sell. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Brian Brody. Have you ever lost your power and simply wanted to flip a switch to turn your lights back on? If so, this message is the most important you will ever hear, because there's never been a better time to get off the grid and generate your own supply of electrical power. Solar power generators are now available. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like running an electric power plant in your own home. Hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, blackouts, you'll never suffer through painful power outages again.
And we are back. If you are interested in purchasing a solar-powered generator for your home or perhaps a solar-powered oven, go to teapartypowerhour.com and click on the appropriate ad. Now, my next guest is Mr. David Oliphant. He is the author of When All Else Fails, Sell. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for having me.
Nothing happens until somebody sells something. Would you agree with that?
Wow, that's one of my cliches. See, I believe that selling is a very noble profession. And I like to also tell people that I'm talking to that just think about it. In the whole world, all through the whole globe, nothing moves until it's sold. Everything eventually has to be sold in one form or another. So, yes, I do agree with that.
I was a pharmaceutical sales rep for 14 years, and I can tell you that for whatever reason, a lot of people like to put pharmaceutical consultant, marketing consultant, or whatever on their business cards. I was a pharmaceutical salesperson, and that's what my card said. So I believe selling is a very noble profession, and I don't know why so many people in sales like to say, well, I'm in marketing or I'm in public relations or whatever, or I'm a information consultant. I always liked saying I was in sales.
That's very, very good what you're saying, because that means you can live with yourself, is the way I put it. And one thing I'd like to mention about the book right now, that this is not a manual or a how-to guide on how to be a salesperson. The book is an inspirational, motivational, beautiful, warm story about a Marine career captain, Mark Whitby, and it starts in Afghanistan. And I'll stop right there. And it's a beautiful story. And, of course, woven into the story are all the principles of being a good person, God is good, prepare, and all the principles of a good salesperson. And the number one principle in my opinion is always be prepared properly.
Now, one of the things I saw in the book is you talked about, you know, the importance of a salesperson to maintain regular contact with their clients, which I always felt was an important thing too. But before we get into some of the specifics, tell us a little bit about the story itself.
Thank you, Mark. As I said, the story starts off with career Marine Captain Mark Whitby, who's leading a four Humvee caravan in Afghanistan, and they're going to a little village, and in that caravan is a very high-powered VIP that they have been instructed to protect at all costs. They mean Mark and his team, who are in a LAV, and which they do when they come on the other side of the village. They're attacked by insurgents, and the firefight is huge, and Mark's LAV, that's the light armored vehicle, blows up. They are not killed. There are four men in there, and Mark Whitby, who wins eventually the Medal of Honor, wipes out all the insurgents, saves the lives of everybody, but he gets shot up pretty good, and his team gets shot up pretty good. And then we follow Mark's career very quickly without being boring. We go to the hospital. We follow him to rehab. We follow him to falling in love. We follow him to getting married. We follow him back to Camp Pendleton in Oceanside, California. He wants to go back to his unit. They won't let him because he's injured. He's recovered beautifully, but he still has some bad injuries. And they give him a desk job, and he doesn't want to be a desk jockey, so he leaves the service. And he cannot fit into the fabric of our society. And that's when the story really starts taking shape and mold. And he just can't get used to it. He wasn't trained for that. And he's a career Marine, and he's very disciplined. He's a very good person. You can't say enough good things about him. And he finds his grandfather, actually his grandfather, who he's never met, finds him, Mark's father himself. His father was killed, was shot down in Vietnam and killed the day Mark was born. And through his grandfather, he literally makes the transition. That's the key that's going on today. Yes, we want our veterans to have jobs. We want all civilians to get jobs. I know there are still tough times out there. But some people need, especially veterans, a transition period, and we should be concentrating on that, not just give them a job. Mark Whitby got a number of jobs, but he didn't want to hold them. He wasn't ready. And the story has a wonderful, upbeat, beautiful finish to the story, and Mark becomes an extraordinarily successful entrepreneur. And
now, are these characters based on real people, David?
These are real people, parts of real people. Like his grandfather, Lawrence Whitby, is a combination of two people.
Gotcha.
And Mark Whitby is a combination of about three people. And that answers your question, I hope.
Oh, absolutely. Now, were you in the service yourself in order to be able to write this type of book?
I was in what was called during World War II in 1944. I was at 9 years old. I was recruited into the Junior Civil Defense.
Wow.
And I had a job at 9 years old in the South Bronx in the ghetto area. And I had to take care of two buildings. Every night was air raid night. Every single night a week was air raid drills. And I had to go through 50 families up and down and bang on their doors to get them to get their shades down, and all the shades had to be black in case it was a real, and it wasn't just an air raid, it was a real, the real deal. And on the streets, I had to stop cars. In those days, the headlights on cars, the headlights looked like popping eyeballs.
Yeah,
and if the car didn't have the top half of the headlight painted black, I had to stop them, jump on the running board and stop them, and that's that. And I did that literally for a little over a year, every single night. And in school, every day we had air raid drills, and I was the monitor of one floor, which had something like, I was in New York City, something like 150 kids on that floor.
Now, I've got to tell you, we've all heard the stuff about pulling the window shades down. This is the first time I've heard the story about having to have the top part of that headlight painted black. Now, that was a requirement during these times, was it?
That was not only a requirement. If you didn't have it and you didn't pull over to the side until the air raid was over and shut your lights off, they didn't pound your car.
Wow. Yeah,
and I'll give you another. Many times when I jumped on a running board, because all the cars in those days had running boards, and I jumped on the running board because the cars were going like maybe 20, 25 miles an hour. It's easy to jump on them.
Right.
Sometimes cars wouldn't stop.
You ever fall off one of those things, David?
I jumped off, yes.
Wow.
I jumped off a number of them.
What would be a car's reason for not stopping? I just can't imagine during these times when everybody was pulling together and, you know, growing victory gardens and everything else that somebody would not have stopped.
Well, you get people who drank too much or whatever, according to the day, the night, or what's going on. You know, people, not all people are perfect.
That's a good point.
That's a good point. Now, what did you think or what did you expect when you wrote this book that the reader's takeaway would be?
That the glass is not half empty. The glass is half full. I wanted them to have the motivation to know there are jobs out there for everybody to get or create. That's a key word, create. That the fact of just going to collect unemployment, I know you need the money for maybe your family and whatever, and I don't want to demean that or talk down against that, but there are jobs out there. Even 2 years ago, there were jobs out there. It's getting a little better now, but it's still not enough jobs. But the biggest thing I was trying to do is to bring awareness that we really need to pay attention to our men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Those are our newest veterans. Sure, we have to take care of the folks that prior to Afghan and Iraq, but these are our newest veterans. These people have put their lives on the line, and I don't want to get political whether it's right or wrong, but they're there. That is a fact of life, and I think we have to, in every possible way, help them fit back into the fabric of our society. There are too many veterans committing suicide. I know I was in San Diego, and I saw almost 8,000 veterans living in tents and waiting twice a day on a line to get food. And I heard a statistic not long ago, there were 100,000 unemployed veterans in California alone.
Mm.
Well, rather than be judgmental and say, wow, there are a lot of programs out there to help the veterans coming back, and we got to make them aware. What I'm trying to do with this book is to make them aware, to motivate them, to pick themselves up by their bootstraps and go do it. There's no reason in the world why they can't not just get a job, they can make the transition into our society.
You know, David, my father served in Korea, and he said when he arrived back from Korea, he couldn't buy a cup of coffee or a sandwich. There was always somebody coming up to him and saying, let me pick that up for you. I just want to thank you for your service to our country. But since Vietnam, our veterans haven't received that type of respect. Talk to me a little bit about the transition between the way Americans used to treat their veterans coming home and the way they're treated now.
Well, that is an incredibly good question. I know during Vietnam I saw people spitting at our veterans coming back. I think a lot of that was because of the movies that were made, that they're always doing drugs and they're always smoking weed and they were always drinking beer. The movie people have to take a little responsibility for that. I also think maybe, and this is a bit of a political thing, maybe it was a war that everybody was against and we shouldn't have been in to begin with.
Right. I'm sure that
there are a lot of bad things happened, and maybe we just shouldn't have been there. But the fact that we were there, we shouldn't have taken that on our soldiers. Because if they were, you know, and then also if they went, it's our obligation to support them. Because they didn't make the decisions to go. The politicians made the decisions to go.
That's the same point today.
I think there's a renewed understanding of these kids who have gone over there today to Iraq and Iran. Iraq and Afghanistan. These kids, you know, boys and girls, they put themselves, their lives on the line. I think we've got to support them. I mean, we can't make it a political issue or this whole country will fall apart.
You know, I was watching a, and you're probably going to wonder how this is going to tie in, but I was watching a TV Land award thing many, many years ago. This was back when we first went into, when we went into Iraq the second time, perhaps. I'm trying to remember if it was the first or the second time we had the issue with Iraq, but technically the first time it was Kuwait, but at any rate, Rob Reiner, the guy who used to play Meathead on All in the Family, got up and made this long anti-war speech, which I've always hated actors that take advantage of an awards ceremony to make a political statement. But at any rate, he does that. You know, he gets a lot of applause from the crowd. And so next, Lee Majors, you'll remember him as the gentleman who played the $6 million man, got up to either give or receive an award. I think he was actually presenting the award. And he said, can we agree on one thing? There are men and women over there risking their lives, and they may or may not agree with the war itself, but they're always ready, and when they're told to go to defend us, they go. So whether you agree with the war or you disagree with the war, can we have a round of applause for those fine men and women who are risking their lives to protect us? And, of course, everybody gave an equal round of applause. And I thought that was fantastic because people that get political about whether we should or shouldn't be in a war oftentimes forget that when you're in the U.S. military, they don't come by and take a survey. You know, what do you think, Hank? You want to go to this one or not? What are your political views? Do you want to serve in this one or are you going to stay back? I mean, that's not the way it works. And yet these anti-war activists always take it out on the soldiers, always, you know, call them baby killers. And as you said, they were spat upon. And that's just not right. I mean, that is absolutely not right. If you have a problem with the war itself, then go talk to the politicians, you know, go spit at a politician if that's what you feel you need to do. But let's be appreciative of the men and women who are willing to put their lives on the line when asked. And I think that's a great point you made, and you made it more eloquently than Lee Majors did. But at any rate, you both were saying the same thing. So, yeah, 100% with you on that. Now, one of the things I'll ask you is that as you wrote this book, did you have or did you draw upon a favorite author yourself? Was any particular author or writing style going through your mind as you wrote this book?
That's another great question, Mark. You know, I have been in sales and in publishing, so this is my 50th anniversary this year.
Wow.
One author who I always loved, and his first book came out in 1967, and that's exactly who I use as a model, and his name is Og Mandino. I don't know if you remember Og Mandino. He wrote The Richest Man in the World, The Greatest Salesman in the World. And he wrote skinny books, and he wrote stories. He didn't write manuals. He wrote skinny books. He ended up writing about 18 books, sold 90 million books. And he passed on, and I think it was 1995, and his daughter took over the estate and all the books that he owns. And his publisher was Bantam Books. Og's first book, he wrote about in the days of Jesus, and he talked about the camel boys, and he did stories about bringing in the silks from the Far East, and the whole story was based around the camel boy, how good he was, he did a good job, and eventually inherited his boss's business, and he became the richest man in the world. But I cut through a beautiful story very, very quickly.
Sure.
I thought it was time. There are two things that I'm going to – that's such a good question. I want to answer it thoroughly. I'll try not to be too long-winded. There are two things. One, I wanted to do a story with a beginning, middle, and end about a veteran, a soldier who's over there and what he's doing and what we've got to do when he's ready to come back into society. I mean, we must support them. I mean, we'd be a terrible society, and this is the greatest country in the world, in my opinion. We're the only country in the world as truly a country of immigrants. And we should be very proud of ourselves. The other thing is, if you look at Arthur Miller and writing Death of a Salesman,
yes,
I didn't like that book. You know, Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman is an iconic book, and who am I to say it? Who am I? Arthur Miller, name will live probably for as long as books live, but that's the way I feel. That's my right. What I didn't like about his book, even though his writing was quite good, the story was okay up to a point, and you had theater, and you had a movie, and here it's back in the theater in New York again, is the fact that Willie Loman, the main character, hung himself at the end of the toward the end of the book because he lost the big order. Oh, my God. What kind of example is that for our young people? And that's on the required reading list of many schools in high school and university. What is that? That we go kill ourselves because we had a bad day or hit a speed bump and didn't get our way or didn't get the order? So tomorrow you'll get two orders.
Excellent point. Let me just say this about the Death of a Salesperson. I remember in college going over that one, and we were discussing why it was Death of a Salesperson, and you know, was Arthur Miller really going after a salesperson's career in general? And what they were saying was is that he wanted to choose a career that everybody could relate to, because everybody's got a salesman in the family somewhere. They felt if he had named it, you know, death of a president or death of a stock trader or death of an investment banker, it wouldn't really have resonated with the people. But they said he was trying to pick a career that everyone could relate to. And, of course, he wanted to pick a career where at times, and we do know this, that the job can be a struggle. You'll note throughout the book he was borrowing money from his brother-in-law because he didn't get that big sale, he didn't get that commission. So I think that they were trying to depict the sales career as being somewhat of a struggle, which at times it can be. Now, that's the point where I stop agreeing with what he was trying to do, because, as you said, there's always tomorrow, there's always that next sale, and if the company you're working for is no longer providing you the good products or services to go out and represent, you find another company. And that the ending was absolutely horrible. And of course there's that it's not quite a soliloquy, but with a brother-in-law is talking about the salesperson out there riding on a shoeshine and a smile, you know. And I think it kind of trivializes what being a salesperson is all about. I can recall when I was a pharmaceutical rep, we hired this guy, and he tried to dress up as a salesperson. Man, he got the shiny ring, and he got the shiny pen, and he had these really shiny diamond cufflinks, and he was trying to emulate what he thought a salesperson should be. And maybe that's what we can say about the book Death of a Salesman, is that it was somebody else's idea of what a salesman is, who the person who wrote it had never been a salesman himself.
So, that's extremely well said, Mark, and I can't disagree with what you've said. Maybe he could have renamed it, you know, the tragedy instead of death. I was toying with the idea of calling, instead of When All Else Fails, Sell, I was toying with the idea of calling it The Birth of a Salesman. But
I like that title.
Trying to move forward, selling is a very noble profession. And, you know, I question anybody, or I'll take the debate on by anybody. Name somebody who has a profession that's not a salesperson.
You're always
name
selling
you
something.
Name your minister, name your priest, name your lawyer, name your politician, name your doctor. Everybody is selling something.
Hey, true.
I started my career teaching, and the classroom was my stage. And I had to sell the young people in the class, the wonderful young people, great memories I had in the classroom, that I was teaching American history, and I had to teach them. And I know I had to teach them, but I also had to sell them on the fact that it's very important for you to learn about the history of your country.
Everybody
is selling. It's a matter to what degree and to what level.
I can't recall the name of the movie. Maybe it was just called The Lifeguard. I don't remember. But it was a story about this lifeguard who was applying for a job selling cars. And the guy that was the sales manager kind of looked at his resume and he said, I don't know. You don't really have any sales experience. And the guy looks back at him and said, basically, I do more public relations on that beach every day than your salespeople do in a month. And, you know, every job involves some type of selling is the point. And, yeah, I 100% agree with you. Everybody has to sell. And I, for one, David, have never understood people that don't want to put that in their title. You know, again, I mean, I was a drug salesman. Everybody else I worked with was a pharmaceutical manufacturer representative.
Well, you know,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Being a drug salesman is something you should be very proud of. I mean, that's dealing and going. If you're going in to see doctors and so forth, you have to know what you're talking about.
Oh yeah.
And you have to have the patience of a saint.
You know it. I've told people many times that are in college who ask how they can get into pharmaceutical sales after they get out of school, and I said, well, one thing I want to tell you is that if you become a pharmaceutical sales rep, you're never out of school, because pharmaceutical sales reps constantly have to take tests to prove that they're qualified to sell a particular line of drugs. You have to know the disease state. You have to know your drug inside and out, and you have to know your competitor's drugs inside and out. And there are always changes going on at the FDA with what exactly your drug is indicated to do or not do and what your competitor's drugs were indicated to do or not do. And you had to stay up on all of that. And so being a salesperson in the pharmaceutical industry, you're never really out of school. But, yeah, it's something I enjoyed. And I can tell you that, you know, I just held my head up with pride. I loved telling people that I was a salesman. So, and I think I'm not sure where that came from as far as people feeling that way. But, yeah, sales is a noble profession. And, in fact, I recall one of my profs lecturing us in college about, you know, go out and, you know, say, you darn right, I'm in sales. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Make your point. And I'll be quiet. Sometimes I need to remember that the show's about to guest. So please go on.
No, that's okay. I heard somebody else talking. I thought I should be quiet.
No, I didn't hear that, so I'm not sure what's going on. No, go ahead.
All right. You know, the other thing is I talk about transition. You know, so many people don't know what's out there, meaning people and veterans and civilians who are looking. There are so many sponsored programs out there for them. One of the programs I love to mention on air is are you familiar with the Leadership Scholarship Program?
I am not. Talk about it.
I'll talk briefly about it. It is 190 colleges and universities signed up for the program. Veterans coming home from either Iraq or Afghanistan can go into the program, and they can go into the lowest level if they have not finished high school, and they will help them to make sure they finish high school, and then roll them right into, after testing and so forth, what they recommend, and roll them into either a 2 or 4 year program into the college and university. This is no charge. And listen to some of the schools, that are available who are signed up for this program: Harvard, Yale, Princeton, UCLA. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So, you know, you're talking about some serious, serious opportunities for everybody.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm willing to wager, and I've contacted every one of those schools, and I provided them with a gift of books and told them I'll give them a book for every veteran at no charge who goes into the program. And
nice.
And I started at the top at Camp Pendleton with the head person there. And it's amazing how getting the word out is so important. So, Mark, what you're doing, I'm very grateful because you're helping us get the word out. This is not a political interview. This is strictly getting the word out to help these kids coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan.
And we want to do that. And this show does deal primarily with political issues, but we certainly have had authors on before who are former military career people, and so that is another area that we do touch on. But I got to tell you, when I look at the television, and I almost never do, but two of my favorite shows when I was able to find time to watch was one, American Idol, because you take people from ordinary lives and you do something to help them, and another one was called Extreme Makeover because it was about helping people. So I love the opportunity to help you help people, David, and I had no idea that this program was out there for our returning veterans. Could you say the name of the program again and let people know how they have
been called? The Leadership Scholarship Program.
And how
Leadership Scholarship Program.
And where do you go to find out about this?
There are 90 colleges and universities that are participating.
Okay. So now, is there any place that someone can go online to find out if there's a college or university in their area that participates?
Well, they can go to their college and go to their college, whether it's a two-year school or a four-year school, go and see if that. Go to their website and see if they're offering the Leadership Scholarship Program. They can also call up their school and ask them if they're offering the Leadership Scholarship Program.
Do you know of anybody that offers it online? Let's say somebody's in a remote area in the middle of nowhere and there's no university within a comfortable driving distance. Do you know of anyone that might be offering it online?
I guarantee you there's some help online. They still should call the college. I don't care if it's 200 miles away.
Okay.
Call college, ask for that program, ask for the admissions officer, and find out the details. And I'm sure if they even went online to a college that's 200 miles away, most of that information of an online education is there. There are so many good schools for military to do this online. They're all over the place. I also recommend that they look at Recruit Military magazine. You'll see in every issue, you'll see at least 10 to 12 .com universities for military.
Well, that is fantastic. I have the ultimate respect for people that are in our military. I did not serve myself, but my father served, my great-grandfather served, my father-in-law served, and I have to tell you, one of the most touching moments I had was when a young soldier currently serving in Afghanistan wrote me a letter thanking me for one of the shows that I did. And I would encourage everybody to get a copy of this book. And let's go ahead and say the name of the title again. It's When All Else Fails, Sell. And this would make a great book, a great gift for anybody you know that has returned from overseas, our young men and women in uniform. Buy a copy of this book and give it to them and help them make that transition from military to civilian life. Now, David, do you have any kind of a special setup where people can go online and buy the book directly from you?
That would be counterproductive. Our publisher is Reader's Digest, and our national distributor is Penguin, and they do a fabulous job. But if they go to my website, I'm giving away free books right now.
Wow. Well, tell people that you're a big fan.
The website is When All Else Fails, Sell. And it's a typical www, or you can do the H something. Mm-hmm. I know there's a number of ways. http://. Mm-hmm. And then you do When All Else Fails, Sell.com/. That's the website. They can go to Facebook if they want. We're trying everything we can to reach everybody, and on our website we're giving away up to 250 free books. And if 300 people came, I wouldn't turn anybody down as long as I have. I've allotted a very large quantity of authors' copy at a special price, so I can afford it, and we're giving them away. I was on the Intrepid 2 weeks ago. The Intrepid was a White House-supported initiative that was a job fair, and we were there 6:15 in the morning and met over 350 veterans, and I couldn't have been more pleased with the way these young people looked and dressed and proper, and their protocol was superb. These are fine young people. So, you know, I would say a little work digging in on these folks digging in, you'll find everything you need online.
We will make it easy on people while you're actually listening to the show. We're going to have a link directly beneath the tool that allows you to, you know, change the volume and so forth and all that stuff. So while people are listening to this show live, they will be able to look just below the audio player, and we will have we'll have a link there for everybody. So you'll just be able to click on that link, and it'll take you the information you need. If you are a returning service person and would like to get a copy of this book, or maybe you know one that would appreciate a copy of this book and you'd like to give them one, you'll be able to take advantage of this free program that David has been so kind and so generous to set up. Now, David, that's all the time we have today, but I just want to thank you for doing this. I mean, this is just a great example of how one human can make a difference in the lives of so many, and we need to see more of this in our society today. So I congratulate you. I thank you. You know, may God bless you for what you've done. And if there's anything else we can help you do here at the Tea Party Power Hour to get the word out, you just let us know.
Mark, I'm honored and thrilled to have had the opportunity, and thank you. You gave me goose pimples for what you said. I will continue spending the rest of my life, as I started my mission to help people in other areas when I first became a little successful, and that takes you back almost 60 years ago.
My goodness.
My family was all military, and one of my family was an astronaut, and I sat on the stoop in World War II and prayed the man in the brown uniform and the bicycle did not stop at our building, because that meant some telegram and some, we just lost somebody. So there's a lot we've got to be thankful for this incredible, wonderful country we live in, and also for the incredible, wonderful leadership, whether it be this president or the next president. We have a great country with great people.
Fantastic, and we lose sight of that all too often, and it's nice to have that reminder once in a while. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, David Alphonse, the author of When All Else Fails, Sell, and we're going to get that link up on our website real quick so you guys can take advantage of this fine and very generous program that David told us about today. David, thank you for being with us.
And thank you very much, Mark, and you should be very proud of yourself. You really are a fine, fine gentleman, and I appreciate your kindness.
Not at all a problem. If I can help you help others, then the reward that comes from that is just amazing. I'm kind of getting misty here, but people just don't understand how small efforts can make a huge difference in other people's lives. And again, I'm not picking on American society at all, but those people that would cling together and help each other and you know, to help take care of each other's families while people were away, and you know, grew those victory gardens. And you know, my father-in-law talks about, you know, everything being for the war effort, you know, the victory gardens, picking up cans, you know, saving metal, doing whatever you could as this country would cling together. And, you know, we haven't had a moment like that in American history in a long, long time. But what you're doing here is very reminiscent of that. So I thank you, and I wish you the best of luck. And you're welcome to come back on whenever you want, David. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
You too. Thank you very much, and you too. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillard.